Well, welcome to this month's Ask Your Rev Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray. From the third Friday of every month.
Could you try a different mic, actually?
Sure. Okay, 1 minute. Let me just try this one here, number three. Let's see what number three is doing tonight. How is this one going? That sounds better, doesn't it? Okay, good. Well, thank you for tuning in, those who have tuned in to this month's Ask Your Herb Doctor. My name's Andrew Murray. As I was saying, every third Friday of the month, we do a 1 hour, well, we do, my wife and I, but it's just myself and has been for a little while now. I do a radio show every third Friday of the month for 1 hour, and it is a call-in. So from 7:30 until 8 o'clock, we have the phone lines open with people asking questions related to the show. And every month, we do a different topic. Sometimes it's a continuation of a topic that may take a month or two or even three to get through. And every month, as has been the custom since about 2007 now, we're joined by Dr. Raymond Pete, who has very much been a mentor and a listening ear, as well as an excellent guide for things that I thought were true once upon a time when I was at university studying herbal medicine, but which have just repeated doctrines and dogmas of professors and other professionals who were taught themselves by mainstream science in all of its splendor, but with its very apparent mistakes and repeated mistakes. Like I said, every third Friday of the month, and we're very pleased to have Dr. Raymond Pete on the phone with us. So let's just see if Dr. Pete's there with us. Are you there?
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks so much, as always, for giving your time every month like you do. I really appreciate it. I wanted, just for the sake of people that have tuned in or are just tuning in for the first time who may have never heard you, if you would just give an outline of your academic and professional background so people can hear where you're coming from.
My early education was in literature, painting, general humanities, including philosophy, and then after about 10 years, in 1968, I went to graduate school in biology, intending to study nerve biology, and finding that that was the most dogmatic of the biological studies, I found the most empirical people in the department were working on reproductive physiology, and so I did my PhD in basically reproductive endocrinology and physiology. 1972 was when I got my PhD, and I've been studying and writing and consulting since then.
Yeah. Okay, good. I wanted just to quickly go back to last month and wrapping up the discussion on the effects of progesterone and how the protectin synapse studies were flawed, and how that whole thing, which showed in the paper that progesterone was not effective, actually had some very bad designs in the trials, and the flawed studies were quite apparent when you looked at the science objectively. And so we gave people information about that and where to go. But I just wanted to say in the and it's kind of shocked me a little bit, because they don't often say these kind of things, a little bit like their reversal on coconut oil being actually good for you now, and the liquid oils may actually be harmful. The American Congress of Obstetricians and Gynecologists actually gave a few guidelines, and I found that these were pretty stunning given the given the debate about sugar. They said that diet, and this was in relation to easing premenstrual syndrome, and this was in relation to estrogen and progesterone, mainly estrogen supposedly being the good hormone and progesterone being the bad, but we know it's the other way around. They said that keeping blood sugar levels up with more smaller frequent meals might be helpful. So I know you've been a big proponent of keeping blood sugar up with something, whether it's liquid milk or orange juice or some liquid food, or in fact a carbohydrate or sugar containing food every 2 hours. I thought that was pretty good. And they also mentioned calcium and magnesium, both found in yogurt and leafy vegetables, for example, and that magnesium might alleviate mood swings and physical symptoms like bloating from water retention. So they're actually giving a thumbs up to sugar, magnesium and calcium, which is good. Before we move on to the subject of sleep and repair, In this month's show, I wanted to go over what you might be able to describe in your terms as the benefits of positive thinking. And also just wanted to mention, for those people that have tuned in, the number to reach us is 707-923-3911. So from 7:30 until the end of the show, 8 o'clock, that's the number to call with questions. So I wanted to explore the remodeling of reality, which is possible from exercising the conscious mind through higher ideals, through positive affirmations, and that this remodeling also benefits the physical body in terms of cell repair, like sleep. And that's going to be one of the topics for a larger part of this show. Now, biblically, the prophet spoke to the people in terms that they could relate to, and they used agrarian concepts and analogies like sowing and reaping, harvest and famine, pestilence and abundance. And now the mind really can be viewed as a garden also, and a good gardener tends his garden. So negative thoughts like doubt and feelings of inadequacy and fear are the weeds which spring up automatically in your garden, sometimes outcompeting the very garden of prosperity with its fruits and flowers, which we all have access to, with a positive mind. So universal quantum and spiritual laws govern our lives, and if you think any other, you're wrong. The soil is your mind, the seed is the thought, the water is your action, and the sun is your feelings. Whatever you plant in your mind and water, the same will also have to grow. There are times or seasons, and you've heard phrases like when the time is right or in due season, for the descriptive spark which ignites the flame of action. So be careful what you plant and give yourself to. And positive affirmations and the cultivation of a beautiful garden of the mind benefit the organism in ways which science is just beginning to put into words, as we are now ready to understand. And I've said many times that we're in the age of knowledge, and it is exponentially increasing. Quantum physics now explains the observer effect, as best demonstrated by the double slit experiment, which shows that the very act of observing interacts with the observed, affecting the outcome. And the same can be inferred that the mind and thoughts can and do affect conscious reality and physical health. So what comes to your mind, Dr. Pete, listening then to the subject of positive affirmation and that your mind is a garden? Do you have any thoughts on that?
In between working in literature and linguistics and going back to school to study biology, I had an experimental college, Blake College, and my theory there was that there are deliberate attempts to plant bad seeds in our garden. And my approach to education was that if you create the right environment, people can uproot those planted bad seeds and create themselves a fresh, new way of looking at the world. And we found that people who had thought they were inferior students in just 4 or 5 or 6 months in that environment where they were expected to be fully functioning became fully functioning and achieved more in 5 or 6 months than the average American college graduate achieves in the whole 4 years.
And this is through a kind of more of a liberal, for the sake of the word being liberal, philosophies to the subject of understanding and learning, rather than just rote memory and recapitulation of facts.
Yeah, because lots of bad intentions are being implanted along with the educational indoctrination that most people are getting.
Yeah, I mean, you've had complete access to that indoctrination in your own studies in terms of what the professors believed and what attitudes they had towards students that were challenging that with some kind of new science perspective, which actually wasn't new, which was actually probably 80 or 100 years old, but had been supplanted, if you like, by the new dogma, especially in genetics and this genetic determinism, the whole theory of it.
Which was powered largely by a political ideology, Malthusianism and genetic determinism were very consciously political ideas, which were then accepted into science, supposedly, because the funding came from the people with that political orientation.
Yeah. It's not a long stretch, but what do you think about faith healing? Just to put it out there, I haven't asked you, haven't prepped you with these questions, but
Well, that's exactly analogous to what we were doing at Blake College, was healing people from the cultural disease they had been given. And there's a fairly recent book, last 20 years, I think, it was published by Larry Dossey called... I think Words That Heal, or Healing Words, something like that.
Okay.
And an older book published in Russian in 1930 and then in English in 1959, Words as Physiological and Therapeutic Factors. The word as a way to handle ideas and thoughts. In both of these cases, they're treating words or thoughts as healing physiological factors. So it's exactly putting into scientific terms that idea of faith healing.
Yeah. I mean, do you think that the concept of... because I've always said, and I've long believed it is true, fortunately or unfortunately for some or even myself, but in terms of medicine, I often find the word diagnosis, it's almost a kiss of death for some people. When you get a diagnosis for something and the doctors or the scientists want to put it in terms that will help you come to terms with what it is that they're diagnosing you with, I find that when people don't actually, because I have got a lot of contact with people who, as you can imagine, and obviously from your background, come from an alternative background, and they're not sold on mainstream medicine, they're not sold on mainstream science, but they're very open-minded and able to understand concepts which certainly are based in science and which maybe they haven't really heard of too much of, but it's there when they go searching for it. So these people that I consult with that maybe haven't had a diagnosis, that they will tell me in terms of symptoms and or other physical facts, point me in a direction where, although I'm not saying it as a diagnosis, because that's not what I do, it's in terms of just generally counseling with people and recommending changes that will be positive. Those people that come with a diagnosis, I think sometimes a diagnosis is a very roadblock to their improvement. And when they haven't come with a diagnosis, but I'm fairly sure what a diagnosis would be if they're in front of a traditional doctor, they make some pretty quick progress through change.
Partly because I had the experience of my father having been diagnosed as a diabetic, and he had acquaintances who were dependent on injecting insulin every day,
right.
And he didn't like that idea, so he wasted away to, I think it was less than 100 pounds, before searching in libraries, they found old books that described using brewer's yeast, and for a few weeks he lived on pure brewer's yeast and completely overcame the conversion of food to glucose in the urine, and put on weight and lived 40 years, 45 years more. And that caused me to ask people how their diabetes was diagnosed. And over the years that I've been doing that, 40 or 50 years, I've only found two or three people who actually had a sane diagnosis in terms of what was known at the time. For example, in the 1940s, it was known that excessive cortisol would create all the symptoms of diabetes, wasting away of the muscles and other tissues, turning it into glucose. As I inquired, I found that the practical approach to diabetes was simply to see if they had high blood sugar, maybe even sugar in the urine, and then prescribe insulin or one of the other treatments to lower the blood sugar. But I don't recall ever running into someone whose cortisol and prolactin and parathyroid hormone and all of the relative things, and growth hormone and so on, whether those were even considered at all in the diagnosis.
So, as a separate subject, perhaps I wasn't going to go in this direction, but we don't have to go there for long. But do you definitively see diabetes as an example here of pancreatic islet cell destruction per se? In terms of, you probably see the destruction in terms of a different process, or is it not? You don't define it like that, even.
Yeah, it becomes a side effect of whatever is ailing you. The stress, which might be malnutrition or emotional stress, overwork, many things can cause the high cortisol, which then damages the beta cells, and the mobilizing the fats from storage during stress. A lack of sleep, for example, creates a diabetic condition.
Right.
And chronic stress, including poor sleep quality, leads to the hormonal situation, which damages the pancreas. And the fatty acids, when you are treating it improperly, you keep exposing the pancreas to these toxic fatty acids. When it turns out that glucose, when it's predominant in the blood, causes regeneration from stem cells, regeneration and differentiation of new beta cells. But when you're under stress and improperly treated, your free fatty acids and cortisol come in and kill the new cells.
All right, good. Well, let's hold it there for a moment, because I think when I'm getting into your sleep and aging newsletter, I think there's reference and relevance to the question of diabetes in there. So for those people who've just tuned in or just listening to the show now, from 7:30 till 8 p.m., we'll open the phone lines up to question Dr. Pete either about this month's subject of going to be the sleep and aging and or the opening topic of positive thinking. The number to reach us is 707-923-3911. Okay, so Dr. Pete, sleep and aging then. So concerning sleep and the varying lengths one species needs compared to another, do you see sleep more necessary for brain repair or restructuring and energy renewal or for tissue repair throughout the body, or all of it? What do you suggest as a, and then what do you suggest as a minimum number of hours for a sleeping adult?
The rest of your body can't repair itself unless it has a brain in good working order. But the most sensitive thing to the stress is the brain itself. But when the brain can't repair itself and impose the resting state on the rest of the organism, then you get things like the chronic excess of free fatty acids and cortisol, which destroy not only the pancreas, but all of the other organs to different degrees.
So these stress hormones directly affect sleep?
When the blood sugar isn't able to produce the carbon dioxide that it should, it's wasted, becomes a lactic acid rather than carbon dioxide, raises the pH of the cell interior, creates a catabolic excited state in which the brain cells ultimately end up dying or being blocked so that they can't act, even if they stay alive. In reaction to the falling oxidation of glucose, you get the rise of adrenaline, which tries to activate cells. It provides more glucose if you have that in storage, and that can remedy the situation. That's why it's there. The adrenaline should bring up the glucose and stop the stress reaction. But if you don't have enough stored glucose, then you resort to the cortisol level of stress adaptation. The cortisol provides the glucose by breaking down your muscle cells and thymus, skin cells, turning it into glucose. And if that glucose doesn't solve the problem, then you get a chronic recurring stress, low blood sugar, increased adrenaline, increased cortisol, and whole breakdown process.
Okay. So I think getting onto the subject of how science and scientists view the brain, and in terms of its overarching control of the body and homeostasis, there seems to be kind of two trains of thought where they have what they call, quote unquote, the cognitive scientists thinking of the brain as a computer, and then other more open-minded scientists looking at the brain as a kind of cybernetic control system with a life. Obviously, it's alive, but a kind of life of its own in terms of being an autonomous functioning unit rather than an on-off switch.
Norbert Wiener, who invented cybernetics in the English-speaking world, I would consider probably the best information theorist in terms of the brain and how it works as a control mechanism integrated intimately with the metabolism of the body. So it's a metabolic control system as well as an interpreter of how the body relates to its ecosystem. Relative to Norbert Wiener's view of the organism, I think you could consider the average cognitive scientist as somewhat autistic or abstracted out of reality.
Okay. Moving on to the subject of energy and what I understand now through talking to you and working with others, in terms of what you've always mentioned as the Achilles tendon reflex being a predominant indicator of hypothyroidism, because the energy state of the cell in a healthy cell ultimately it is charged, electrically charged, positively rested and ready to begin an action potential, and that in the tendon reflex, when there's a slow return to the resting state, that shows that the cell has been overstimulated. And just like in sleep, if we don't get enough sleep, we are essentially too excited, in terms of people that are insomniacs, for example, too excited to be able to get that relaxation so that we have that energy in the morning when we get up, like we do when we're healthy and strong and we get lots of sugar in our diet and our thyroids are good and vitamin D and everything else and calcium, so that we're charged and ready to go. So the ability to relax and to accumulate energy and the substance for differentiation, then this is a predominantly oxidative high energy production system.
And as a third dimension of this, comparing the brain to the cramping calf muscle in the Achilles reflex test, if you think of the cancer cell as an energy-deprived, overexcited cell, it has the exact situation of the fatigued or seizing brain cells or the cramping muscle cells. Deficiency of sugar or oxygen will cause cramping in the muscles, insomnia or seizure in the brain, and compulsive growth and fusion in a cancer cell.
And so this what we call excitotoxicity, the term for this then, it would refer very well to cancer cells. They're just completely excited and unable to relax, ultimately. Apart from apoptosis and the regular cell death mechanisms by which normal cells or the body maintains its normalcy rather than growing out of control or out of the bounds of what's needed of it.
Some doctors have mentioned that you could diagnose cancerous lymph nodes in the armpit in relation to breast cancer just by touching them without needing to do a biopsy, because it turns out that cancer cells are hardened the same way a cramped muscle is hardened. Mm-hmm. Just by the touch of a cancer cell, it shouldn't be hard. It should be relaxed and full of energy, ready to work. But it's in the cramped working state.
Right. Interesting. Okay. So this is when they describe these things. Okay. So, well, here's the thing. Don't they describe soft tumors and hard tumors? Don't they have a different? The doctors, as it is, you know, don't have a differentiation for these kind of tumors, or?
Well, the soft tumor is harder than that tissue is normally.
Right. Right. Okay. So the hard tumors is just sort of the stage beyond that. Okay. All right. Well, it's coming up to 7:30 now. So if people want to call in about this month's topic, sleep and aging and or the positive thoughts, affirmations, and how that controls our reality in terms of the double slit experiment and the actual evidence of an observer effect, changing the state of the observed, and the whole quantum physics thing. I know it's a pretty big subject, but I think it's totally open to debate in terms of supporting its tenets. The number is 707-923-3911. I do see the lights flashing, so I think we do have our first caller. Caller, you're on the air. What's your question and where you from?
Yeah, from Brooklyn, and question is right on topic. About a month ago, out of the blue, I developed a rash on my neck, inside of my forearms and in my underarms. Just red. It's just very red and bumpy. So it appears like there's a little bit of fibrosis. Never had this before. Other than that, have no issues. 60-ish. And at night, it wakes me up, or seems to be correlated with waking up between 1 and 2, literally only sleeping like 2.5 hours, 3 hours. Then I'm up for several hours and I go back to sleep. So the comment about sleep and aging and the comment about sort of diagnosis sort of is brought together here with this issue, because I did go to a dermatologist and they said, oh, you have this rash. And they gave me a product called triamcinolone acetonide cream, which has precautions of allegedly reversible HPA axis suppression, manifestations of Cushing's syndrome, hyperglycemia, and glucosuria, all of which apparently are reversible. So I didn't fill it, but it's been 30 days. I've tried a bunch of different things, kind of like your father did with the brewer's yeast, and the thing is still there. So I was just wondering, for what would say an otherwise, you know, Ray P type diet, which has been very positive with eyesight, you know, muscle strength, no pain in the joints, all that's good, but this rash comes out of nowhere, and it's literally going on a month now, so it's becoming chronic, which has elevated my concern. So in summary, I didn't take the antibiotic they provided, and I'm not taking anything other than putting, you know, some aloe vera on it. Somebody recommended something called rosehip oil, which does have, you know, maybe some PUFA-related additives, and something called, you know, black cumin seed oil, which also has omega-6s in it, I mean 50%. But these are things I've been trying, and I was just wondering whether you have any commentary on both the sleep issue and, you know, what one might do to get rid of the stress associated with this skin rash.
Yeah. Okay, well, no, the rosehip oil was probably a vitamin C component of that, although you mentioned the oil was probably a polyunsaturate. But Dr. Pete, what do you have to say about the rash that he's just described?
The first thing I would do, or that I do whenever I have a symptom like that, is to put lots of sodium chloride. Get it for ice cream freezers, so you can put a couple of pounds in a bathtub and about a pound of baking soda and make a slightly hyperosmotic solution and soak in it for a while. And that usually takes care of minor skin problems. But some people make an application of baking soda and sodium chloride just as a soothing thing, but it has much of the effect that a drug like triamcinolone or the glucocorticoids in general, which doctors love because they
right.
they'll make everything feel better, even if it's making you sick in the long run.
Yeah, exactly. It was definitely a Band-Aid approach, kind of what Andrew was saying earlier. So you're saying a pound of sodium chloride, that's not salt, though. It's, you got to say, you've got to be careful.
Yeah.
Right?
Just any clean salt and standard baking soda, make a fairly salty a bath and soak in it for half an hour or more.
Okay, so it's a pound of baking soda and a pound of sodium chloride?
Something like that. It doesn't have to be exact, but when people experiment with the solutions, it can be up to two or three times as concentrated as seawater, and the average seawater is about twice as concentrated as our body fluids for sodium.
How about that dry CO2 you talked about in the past? Is that worth doing too? Or is
the,
that
the CO2?
The dry CO2 bath, is that?
The baking soda has that function because the sodium holds the bicarbonate in solution so it doesn't bubble out of the warm water. But your body has such a high affinity for carbon dioxide that it will pull, even the bicarbonate will be pulled into your body against the gradient, which the body is already pretty concentrated with CO2, but the bicarbonate will help to increase that. The warm water doesn't hold much gaseous carbon dioxide, but it's a healing component in mineral water, which is carbonated. But it's a very low concentration compared to what you could get from the baking soda. And a pure CO2 dry bath instantly starts raising your body's carbon dioxide with anti-inflammatory effects. There's a good article published in a U.S., I think, Michigan State Medical Journal, 1905, on the uses of a carbon dioxide gas bath.
Is that good to do as a separate matter, like for 30 minutes? I mean, it makes I did it once, and it was cold initially, but then it sort of makes your skin hot, which is kind of odd.
Because it relaxes the blood vessels. And when you notice your skin getting pink, that means you're fairly well saturated with it.
Got it. So does it matter whether you do it 10 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour? Does it matter? Is it better to do it like maybe, given that I have a chronic condition, like a few times every day or a couple times a day until this goes away?
I think it's fine to do it an hour or more every day. If you're doing something like strengthening your bones, some recent Japanese studies have tried it, applying it externally to the skin for squamous cancer of the mouth and getting good results.
Right. Okay, that's great. And the sleep thing about getting up between... So I get up, and then, like, I have a carrot salad or something, and it's a glass of milk, and then I use the red lamp, and I can get back to sleep, but that's a lot of work. I mean, seems like I ought to be, you know, to your point about degeneration of the brain, et cetera. I mean, my brain seems okay right now, but, you know, getting a straight shot of 6 hours, you know, with 3 1.5-hour cycles, maybe a little bit of dreaming would be a much better thing than waking up at, you know, sleeping 3.5 hours, waking up for 2 hours, then sleeping another 3.5 hours to get 7 or 4 hours to get 7.5 hours of sleep.
I think the main thing that causes that age-related interrupted sleep is things like decreased thyroid function slow your digestive processes. And as your blood sugar falls in darkness and when you're sleeping, the falling blood sugar lets you experience a toxic reaction to the whatever is in your intestine. And the irritation, inflammation, and absorption of endotoxin and surges of serotonin from the intestine, those get into the bloodstream. Finish off your stored glycogen and wake you up with a stress reaction. And so trying to have the calmest, cleanest intestine possible at bedtime. So
does that mean having a carrot salad before bed or something? Because it doesn't seem like I have a stomach ache or any problems or anything. I mean, maybe it's, is it always the case that it has to be the intestine? You know, I mean, I don't know. I guess. What do you do to prevent this?
Having a carrot salad or a good bowl of cooked mushrooms or some slightly antiseptic fiber like that in the early afternoon, and then having a fairly low-protein, high-carbohydrate supper right before bed, like ice cream or a chicken broth that's very salty, got combination of salt and sugar right at bedtime, helps to relax the intestine for a longer period.
Okay, well, we do have another caller on the line. Caller, I appreciate you calling in, and I just want to make sure we give time to other people that are lined up. For those who are listening, the number here is 707-923-3911. With Dr. Pete on the line. So let's take this next call. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
Hello, am I on the air?
Yeah, where are you from and what's your question?
I'm from Arcata, California.
Okay.
I have a question about the brewer's yeast and the diabetes, and I'll take an answer off the air, but I'm just wondering, I have to give myself an insulin injection every day. I'm very attracted to the idea of not having to do that, but how might one, well, A, why does brewer's yeast work, and did Dr. Pete's father just eat nothing but brewer's yeast? How might one transition from a possibly healing brewer's yeast diet and get off insulin? Or anyway, that's my question. Just some elaboration on diabetes and brewer's yeast. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
I think one of the functions of brewer's yeast is the high niacin.
Elaboration on.
Okay, you need to turn your hang up the phone. I think so. Okay, go ahead, Dr. Pete. See.
The high niacin content of the brewer's yeast is a very effective thing for lowering the free fatty acids, and the free fatty acids are the main things killing the beta cells. And there are a couple of articles on glucose and diabetes on my website that. Described the results of a couple doctors in the late 19th century and a high sugar diet. But niacin and sugar are two things that hold down the liberation of the toxic free fatty acids. And anything you can do to interfere with those free fatty acids, which are toxic to the pancreas, will help it heal.
Okay, good. All right, let's hold it there. Okay, so unless there's no one else at the moment, just check in with the engineer. There's no, okay, good. All right, so...
Actually, I had a question, Michael from Woodway calling.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you talk a little about water and the best water and about how much water and the importance of water in the diet?
I know Dr. Pete doesn't really believe in drinking water, but let's ask Dr. Pete what his opinion is about water. Yeah, go ahead.
If you're really thirsty, water is what you need. But if you're drinking milk and orange juice to get your calories and protein and calcium and so on, you usually don't need any plain water because the amount of water you're taking in to get those nutrients is usually on the order of a gallon or so.
Okay, there you go. Good. All right, well, the lights have started flashing in the studio again, so the engineer's answering the call. Let's see if you have another caller here. No, okay, they hang up. All right. So, Dr. Pete, I just wanted to move on in terms of the sleep and aging article that you mentioned here that the concentration of cortisol found in the blood started to increase when the light was turned off, and that this darkness is a stimulus for cortisol production. And now this is whether the person was asleep or not. So just the pure presence of darkness, obviously this is why the long winter nights are probably very damaging for most people because they just don't get enough exposure to sunlight. And showing that the stress of darkness creates an inefficient catabolic state where you start breaking yourself down. And this is mainly from cortisol, again, in order to generate glucose. And that sleep to some extent reduces the stress. But you mentioned, and this is again part of red light therapy and red light treatment that people use just during the daytime for things like skin conditions, as you mentioned, that first caller from Brooklyn, perhaps the red light there. That red light itself is a electron quenching wavelength of light. The stress of darkness, you know, we sleep every night, and this month about the article on stress, sleep and aging, the stress of darkness is itself very damaging. And you mentioned here where cortisol rises, generating free fatty acids and all those stress hormones that are very harmful to us. But yet the sleep is so necessary, and deep sleep especially so necessary for tissue repair and cell healing, that it's a kind of double-edged sword. You know, you get exposed to darkness, whether you're sleeping or not, but especially when you're asleep, and your cortisol starts to rise. But that red light and exposure, a pre-bedtime exposure to red light, can mitigate a lot of this.
The Chinese study found that it not only improved the depth of the sleep, but it improved the athletic performance the next day after the good sleep. Following the red light treatment.
Wow.
About 40 years ago, someone experimented with putting living tissue, for example, a seed was a very self-contained, easy-to-study material. They found that if it was exposed to ultraviolet light or sunlight, and then you put it in an electron spin resonance machine or paramagnetic resonance device to measure free radicals or free electrons, that after the ultraviolet light exposure, it kept in the machine, it would show free radicals or free electrons for hours and hours without any new exposure. But if they, right after putting it in the machine, if they shined red light on it, it went quiet. The red light just knocked out the free radicals immediately. And experiments with gamma rays on frogs showed the same thing. A dose of gamma rays that would kill the frogs, if it was followed immediately by red light exposure, it quenched the excited electrons, and the frogs didn't die.
In the past, we've talked about, we've done a show on red light and light in general in terms of its anti-inflammatory effect. What kind of distance under the skin? I mean, do you think red light will penetrate the deepest core of the body?
You know, when someone has their back to the sun, how red their ears look, or if you put a flashlight under your hand in the dark, you see the red light coming right through your hand. One night, I let my eyes get adapted by sleeping until about 4 in the morning, and then put a red light behind my thigh, and I could, my whole thigh was illuminated a bright red color, except the bone left a shadow.
Right.
Like an X-ray.
Okay. All right. So I wanted to carry on here with just another reference to the permanently contracted, unable to relax state of cells and this relationship to stress. And in the elderly, okay, so most, and again, I'm fortunate, you know, I don't know about you. I think you probably have very good sleep too, but I've never had a problem sleeping, and I sleep, I can sleep for 10 hours for sure. And I wake up feeling just fine, and I don't get any kind of insomnia. If I wake up at all in the night, I'm back to sleep in about 30 seconds. And so with old people though, right, as people get older, they talk about people needing less sleep. And I think this is a bit of a misnomer. I don't think people need less sleep. I think people need the same amount of sleep. And when they don't get it, they get less relaxation. So they talk about the elderly and that their heart's failing, and the muscle being another typical muscle. I mean, although cardiac and skeletal muscle do have physiological differences, they're still muscles. And when the cardiac muscle can't relax, just like a skeletal muscle can't relax when it's overexcited and it the thyroid hormone is not adequate enough to allow relaxation fully, they basically get these heart failure type pictures, scenarios coming on as part of their old age. And it's not at all related to their old age. It's because they just don't have enough relaxation going on. So how about this in terms of the elderly and the inability to relax, or their insomnia, and it's related to their cardiac cycle?
I think it's exactly the same thing. The heart doesn't beat strongly because it doesn't relax fully. The diastolic relaxation just isn't there as the energy production decreases. And the same thing with the brain. The relaxation is impaired the same way as the heart relaxation.
All right. So now, getting on to that, revisiting rather the red light thing, that you stated in your newsletter here that if you're exposed to it at the beginning of the night, it can not only improve your sleep, but also the next day's performance. And this was a Japanese paper that was written in 2012. So they have objectively looked at the performance of a group of people that they were studying who actually physically performed better the next day, directly proportional to their red light exposure the night before.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, incredible. Okay. So the number here, if anyone's listening and they want to question Dr. Pete, is 707-923-3911. So I had a question that was posed by a person. I think they wrote this question in. And I wonder, actually, if it may have got asked last month. But let me ask you again. Somebody who was wondering about using pregnenolone, and I think because of bad publicity or whatever else, you know, that they've been worried about progesterone and pregnenolone, they've kind of put them in the same basket. They've read about this subject called pregnenolone steel, where people with worn out adrenals apparently get this issue where pregnenolone is stolen and converted into cortisol. Is that even possible?
Oh, whenever you are making cortisol, you're making it from pregnenolone, ultimately. Mm-hmm. And you should have a huge excess of pregnenolone and progesterone and only make small amounts of the terminal hormones such as cortisol and estrogen as needed. But the bulk of the steroids produced should be heavily in favor of pregnenolone and progesterone, because those are stabilizing materials. I don't even consider those to be hormones.
Right.
The only direct action that has been identified for pregnenolone is that it helps tissues give up excess water, and it allows the fascia, the connective tissue, to regain its normal tone, and so it can, when you reach the right level, it can make wrinkles in your saggy neck skin disappear.
Okay. All right. Well, let's take this next caller. Caller, you're on the air. Where are you from? What's your question?
I'm up on Wilder Ridge. I wanted to know about the red light. Is it like a light bulb, a lamp that you have on in your bedroom, or?
Yeah.
I wanted you to elaborate on the red light.
Well, the sunlight or any incandescent light bulb has a spectrum. The sunlight is the middle of the sun spectrum is yellow. The middle of an incandescent light bulb spectrum is orange. And you get the full red light benefit either from sunlight or incandescent light bulbs. You don't have to get rid of it except for convenience. You don't want a brilliant shiny room around you if you're trying to relax, and so the dim quality of bright red light, it isn't necessarily any brighter than a 200 watt incandescent bulb would be, but you don't need the blue and green part of the spectrum for the therapeutic effect.
Those bulbs that are supposed to be like daylight, are they too bright?
No, if you don't need the bright white light, during the daytime, I have a 250-watt reflector bulb called an infrared bulb, but it looks like an ordinary white light, but it runs at a lower temperature than a standard bright incandescent bulb, so it's heavier on the red part of the spectrum.
I got you. Thank you so much for your time and your effort and all your love, Dr. Pete. You're awesome.
Okay, thank you for your call, caller.
Thank you.
So, again, presumably, the more skin you can bear to a red light, the better the absorption of the light, although I'm sure to some extent, whether you're wearing a T-shirt or a light shirt, red light will penetrate some of that.
Yeah, people have experimented with pigeons, despite their feathers. They can see the systemic effect coming through their body because the red light penetrates pretty much anything living material.
Cool. All right, we have another caller. So, caller, you're on the air. Where are you from, and what's your question?
New York. It's just related to the points just made on the pregnenolone. How do you know whether you need it? I mean, you mentioned older people and stuff. I mean, because I think in previous shows, Dr. Pete, you said you took it for a while, and now you no longer take it. So I'm just wondering, how does one decide whether you should be taking it or not?
In the 1980s, when I had first experimented with it, a lot of younger people wanted to try it, and good, healthy people in their 30s and early 40s felt nothing. They could take a spoonful and have absolutely no noticeable effect. But when someone was in their late 40s or early 50s and feeling hopeless and depressed, even a pinch of it, 15 or 20 milligrams, in 15 minutes, their faces would light up and they would grin and get ambitious projects going again, decide not to quit their job. When you need it, it's a very vivid effect, even with a small amount.
Okay, so you're saying that the trigger would be, hey, if you're feeling really down. But if you're not feeling really down, you're doing all the other stuff, and your energy's pretty steady, and you're as lucky as Andrew to sleep the way he sleeps, that's pretty impressive. Then you're saying your body probably makes enough of it?
Yeah.
Okay, and that's probably why you don't take it. The other thing is on water. I think in one of your write-ups, you mentioned water earlier. Babies are 80% water, and older people are 55% water. So I'm just wondering, and I guess high metabolic rate relates to high water percentage in the body. If you're older, how is it not possible if you have dropped to a much lower percentage of water that you wouldn't need more water? Maybe it's sparkling water to get the CO2.
The CO2 and the ATP are the things that hold good water in the cells while squeezing out unwanted, improper water. Pregnenolone, progesterone, ATP, and CO2 all have that effect on the cytoplasm in particular to keep it from taking on disorganized water, but making it hang on to the water that's organized and running its metabolism. So I think old people will take up a lot of cellular metabolic water that increases their metabolic rate when they repair their mitochondria, reduce the stress hormones.
So you're saying there's good water and bad water in hanging around your cells?
A healthy kid's cell that contains lots of water is metabolizing intensely, keeping its CO2 up and its lactic acid down. The water is part of letting the cell run at a high rate. And you can restore some of that metabolic active water with those things such as progesterone, pregnenolone, thyroid, and carbon dioxide.
Okay, great answers. One last quick question.
Yeah.
Vitamin A, D, K, how do you know what ratio and how much you actually need, particularly for, you know, people as you age? I mean, how do you know that, and how do you get it? What's the ratio, for example, of A to D? Is it 5-1? Is it 4-1? Or
I don't think there's a definite ratio, because as your thyroid function increases, you're able to use lots of vitamin A in making pregnenolone and progesterone. It's coordinated with thyroid hormone and cholesterol to convert cholesterol into the good hormones. And if your thyroid is low, then too much vitamin A interferes and lowers the thyroid function.
Can I ask you a quick question, Dr. P? I know we've got to wrap it up here because it's just a couple of minutes to the top of the hour, but in terms of pregnenolone and its production, or rather its conversion, cholesterol is the main building block from which these hormones are built from, correct?
Yeah, and the reason cholesterol rises with age is that things like low thyroid function and low vitamin A availability interfere with the production of pregnenolone and progesterone, and so your body compensates by increasing the cholesterol, and the cholesterol increase can cause your tissue production of pregnenolone and progesterone to increase up to the limit of the cell's capability governed by vitamin A and thyroid.
Okay. Hold it there, Dr. Pete. Let's get the last minute or two just to let people know where they can find more of your information. Thanks for your time.
Okay.
Okay, so for those people who have called in, thanks for your calls. There's other people that called in. I don't think they got a chance to ask questions, but thank you for trying. For those people who want to find out more about Dr. Pete, his website is www.raypete.com, and he's got lots of articles that are fully referenced, as only a post-grad student would produce a paper. So lots of references there for all the things that he's saying. And for that caller with the Brewer's yeast question and diabetes, that there's a couple of good articles there on his website which go into great detail about diabetes and the dysfunction that is part of the cause. For those people who wanted a call but didn't and just listened, Dr. Pete is still doing what he's doing. So thank you very much, Dr. Pete, for your tireless effort. And until the third Friday of next month, what with the solstice coming up here, we'll see you then.